Mr. Nyman here. Ms. Duffy, do you know anything about Mr. Nyman?
I do not, Your Honor. I've not been in contact with him.
Okay. Why don't we do this? Why don't we skip to the next case of the day and see if anybody, if that's not a problem for you?
No, that's fine, Your Honor.
Okay. Let's go to Ginger Cove Common Area Company versus Weekhorst. Mr. Arney?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief.
Good morning
Justice.
To you.
Morning. Counsel, if it please the court, counsel, gallery. Your Honors, we're here due to what the appellee, I would say, accurately characterized as a peculiar procedural history in this matter. As the record reflects, this matter was dismissed rather spontaneously, I believe, on September 29, 2015. Shortly thereafter, the trial court entered an order holding the appellant in contempt, or at least ordering sanctions against the appellant for failing to comply with discovery requests that had been served upon him some time previously. I think it would be appropriate to first address the appellee's contention that this appeal was filed out of time. They argue that it was untimely because the order of sanctions dismissed the appellant's counterclaims, and that was a final appealable order. And so there was 30 days to appeal from that point, as opposed to 30 days from the point at which judgment was entered in this matter. This was not a final appealable order, the order of sanctions, because that order did not determine the action and prevent judgment. That order simply struck the pleadings. It was not a dismissal of those claims with prejudice. Also, those claims that were presented in the counterclaims were still within the statute of limitations, so had the appellant wanted to refile those claims, I believe he could have. Second, this was not the order on the motion to vacate the sanctions was not an order made during a special proceeding. The appellee cited the Jarrett case, which would say that a special proceeding is a civil proceeding outside of Chapter 25, the Nebraska Revised Statutes. However, that case was from 1993, and in the year 2000, with LB 921, the language was added to Chapter 25, stating that the court had the power to modify its own orders and vacate its orders within its terms. We would suggest that at that point, the motion to vacate became a proceeding within Chapter 25 and not a special proceeding. So this was not out of time.
If your counterclaim was completely struck, you mentioned earlier it didn't prohibit a judgment. How would you gain a judgment on your counterclaim if your pleading had been struck?
Well, we would argue the pleading had been struck, but there was not a judgment with prejudice as to those claims. I would argue that had the...
I get your argument, but the realities are, how would you get a judgment if that pleading was never reinstated? How would you ever get a judgment on that?
We'd have to refile the case. You'd have to file his own separate action.
Correct.
Right. Okay. And then proceed to trial on the merits on those.
Wasn't this a determination within this case, then?
Within this case, but not, it wouldn't prevent judgment on those actual claims. Within this case, it would, but that okay. They had not been dismissed with prejudice.
Well, let's just say hypothetically that you missed the appeal time and that's a final order. Well, since the judge didn't say without prejudice, and if there's no statute of limitations, then wouldn't it be the proper thing to then file a separate proceeding?
I don't know that it would have been. I think the proper thing to do would have been, had the client wanted to, refile his case as opposed to appealing interlocutory at that point. I think had we wished to, we could have filed a separate action at that point and just refiled the claims, because they had not been dismissed with prejudice. They were still viable actions that could have been brought. There was not judgment on the merits of those. With regards to the appeal itself, the appeal of the merits of the appeal, we argue that the motion to vacate the order of sanctions was improperly denied because, as you look at the history, the case was dismissed for whatever reason, I believe on September 29, and then it was reinstated and dismissed again and reinstated again in a very strange manner. And what it comes down to is we argue that it violated the appellant's procedural due process rights, which are intended to give a party appropriate notice of when something is going to happen that might affect their rights. And
counsel, there is no bill of exceptions in this case. You chose not to present a bill of exceptions, correct?
I thought the bill of exceptions was presented. If I'm remembering wrong, I'm remembering the transcript.
The transcript is
you're right, Your Honor. I think there was no bill of exceptions.
There's no bill of exceptions. Okay, we're on the same page there.
We are.
Can we tell from the transcript when the hearing on the motion for sanctions, not the motion to vacate, but when the hearing on the motion for sanctions actually occurred?
From the transcript, I don't recall if you can. The court entered its order. Don't recall if you can from the transcript. I know the dates of the orders are reflected in the transcripts.
October 5th rendition of that order.
There it is.
And October 6th entry. But the order itself doesn't recite, does it, when the hearing occurred?
No, it does not. It does not. As being involved in the case, I just kind of assumed when everything took place. And if you look at the procedural history also, you can see from the transcript even on October 1st, the appellee filed a motion to reinstate the case, and it was set for hearing later on that morning. And then the next thing is October 5, the order to reinstate, and then October 6, another motion for sanctions is filed. So as you continue through the procedural history, we'll see the case gets dismissed and reinstated. There's a motion to reinstate the case filed by the appellee, I believe, on December 10. An order to reinstate was entered that day. The certificate of service shows that motion was sent to the appellant back in October. And so the case was dismissed, reinstated without appropriate notice to the appellant. And perhaps, maybe even likely, the dismissal was a clerical error. All right. However, at the time, on September 29, when the case was dismissed, it was dismissed. And October 1st, the court entered an order, and the appellee discussed the order that said at the time of the order of sanctions being granted that appropriate notice was served on the appellee. Well,
that's the October 5th order, isn't
right,
it?
Right. And we argue no, appropriate notice was not served because on September 29, the matter was dismissed. And so the hearing, which was scheduled for October 1st, was a nullity because the matter was dismissed. The court lacked jurisdiction at that point.
That returns me to my previous question. Doesn't your argument assume that the hearing occurred on October 1st?
It would assume that.
And the record doesn't establish that it either did or didn't occur on October 1st, does it?
I don't believe it does. That's right. There's no way to tell when that hearing took place. And if there's no way to tell when that hearing took place, we can't tell if appropriate notice was given to anybody. And so we would argue that with the whatever the errors were, whether they were clerical errors or this was dismissed for want of prosecution as it had been previously, the fact is on September 29, the case was dismissed and the record does not reflect appropriate notice of reinstatements being given to the appellant. Further, although the appellee is correct that a court can hear motions as it sees fit on its own time, at the same time, the court needs to follow its own rules with respect to when it hears motions. And the rules of the, I think it's the 4th District up there in Douglas County, require timely notice to be given to the other party of a hearing. And
I'm still a little puzzled as to what the record would show happened then on October 1st.
The record doesn't show much of anything. Well, the transcript shows, we can, just a common sense reading of the transcript shows the case was dismissed on September 29, and then on October 5 or 6, it was reinstated in an order of sanctions entered. And there's no record of a hearing set for October 1,
no,
which...
No notice of hearing. Would the record demonstrate electronic service or something?
I don't know if it was...
More modern.
Electronic or something more archaic with, you know, mail. The hearing of October 1st was known about because that motion had been filed before the case was dismissed on September 29, and the transcript will show that. But then on September 29, the matter was dismissed. And so at that point, I think the court lost jurisdiction. And then through the course of reinstating the case, dismissing it, reinstating it a couple of times, I don't think the court followed its own rules. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning, sir. Is it Mr. Rowland?
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Justice, members of the Supreme Court, opposing counsel and co-counsel, my name is Lawrence Rowland with the Gross & Welch Law Firm, representing Ginger Cove as they existed as a counterclaim defendant. Mr. Thompson will speak to them as the plaintiff in this case. I was discussing earlier, this is the quintessential case to have in front of a law school because it has a little bit of everything. Local rules, supplemental filings inside of the court themselves, some clerical jumping the gun with some possibly improper dismissal for failure to prosecute, and special proceedings, which are always somewhat troubling for the court. And in this case, there are two specific dates in which I have a special proceeding that allows for this court to conclude that there was a final appealable order that Mr. Weekhorst did not exercise his ability to appeal within the 30 days.
If we disagree that either the motion for sanctions or the motion to vacate is a special proceeding, do you concede that we have jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
But again,
I realize you're not conceding the premise of my question.
Thank you, Your Honor. But if we were going to start with that hypothetical, yes, this court would have jurisdiction if neither of those two are special proceeding. And while Mr. Arnie focused on the September 29th through October 6th timeframe itself, I think what's easier for this court to put its head around is the hearing in February of 2016 after the motion to vacate and set aside was brought up.
Let's talk about that for a second. Doesn't that motion to vacate and the denial of it leave the case in exactly the same posture that it was before the hearing on the motion to vacate?
Yes, Your Honor. That would be the status of the case on September 28th, the day before it was first dismissed.
I'm talking, assuming we have the record that says the order on sanctions was entered on October 6th. And after October 6th, until the filing of the motion and the hearing on the motion, and then when you compare that period of time to immediately after the ruling on the motion to vacate, nothing changed, correct?
No, that's not correct, Your Honor, because in December of 2015, there was another motion to reinstate that was granted.
Well, nothing changed with respect to the court's ruling on the order of sanctions.
I understand. Yes, Your Honor, correct. Nothing had changed on that.
The court imposed the sanction in October on the motion to vacate. It didn't change its mind. So before that ruling, there was a sanction. After that ruling, there was exactly the same sanction.
Yes, Your Honor.
So how could that order have possibly affected a substantial right?
Because it completely eliminated the counterclaims of Mr. Weekhorst.
Wasn't that already done?
Correct, on the October 6th one. And again, what the argument that Ginger Cove as the counterclaim defendant is trying to make is, assuming the worst case scenario, the facts against Ginger Cove, the absolute latest that Mr. Weekhorst should have filed this appeal was in March, a month after February. We'd love to be able to argue they should have filed it in November, but that's a little bit harder because of the status of the case from September 29th through October 5th, and then again from October 10th to December 10th. So it's an easier argument to make that says, we'll just look at that February 19th order and say that was the special proceeding that affected a substantial right that had 30 days from which to appeal.
why wouldn't that simply have been an interlocutory order that ruled on, in effect, a motion to reconsider a previous order? Because you don't have judgment yet. Judgment occurs later. So isn't that order interlocutory? I guess I'm not understanding why you think it's a final order.
Because a final order, according to how this court has defined it, is something that affects a substantial right and has any one of three different subheadings to it. I'm not worried about the first one or the third one. I just want that middle one, the special proceeding.
And then we return to my previous question, which was, if it isn't a special proceeding, then you can see
yes, Your
there's
Honor.
Jurisdiction. All right, thank you.
And then taking that step back, once I have a special proceeding and the idea that there was 30 days from that February 19th order, then the motion to appeal or the notice of appeal should have been filed in March of 2016, not May of 2016.
Assuming that we have jurisdiction, what's your argument on the merits about where we are, we're left if we have jurisdiction?
So discovery was sent out initially in December of 2014, and 2 years and some change later, it still hasn't been responded to. Prior to the court's, the clerk's initial notice of dismissal, there was a motion for summary judgment, a motion to compel, and a motion for sanctions, all of which said you have to deliver discovery, and that hasn't been done yet. And not once, not twice, but three times, the district court said, you're in contempt of my motion to compel to get you to deliver discovery.
What significance do you think it has, if any, that we do not have a bill of exceptions?
Very essential. Without having any kind of record to understand what was argued or what was decided, what the court has before it are the orders inside of the transcript, which says that you've got proper notice, all parties were present and knew what was happening there, that I have this kind of problem, I still have contempt of the court's August 29th order, and sanctions in the form of striking counterclaims is proper.
Now, the October 5th, 6th order expressly recites that your opponent was not present, correct?
That is correct. But that's nothing new. That was nothing new up until that point in the entirety. That's the reason why there was a motion to compel. That's the reason why there was a motion for sanctions. Mr. Wecourse not being present at a hearing, that wasn't surprising in this case. That doesn't make it right or wrong. That doesn't mean that's something that this court should consider. But it was nothing out of the ordinary for Mr. Wecourse to not be represented up until that point. Mr. Arney then takes over because Mr. Arney was brought in later. He wasn't the initial attorney for the Wecourses themselves. When Mr. Arney files his motion to vacate and set aside in January of 2016, he's recognizing the district court's authority as established either in October or December of 2015. And he sets in motion what he needs, what he thinks he's going to appeal, and that is the order in October. And in February, the 17th is when the hearing, the 19th is when the order comes down, the court says, this is very easy. You were told to deliver discovery, a motion for sanctions was filed, here are the proper sanctions, your counterclaim is struck.
He doesn't need to really say it again. He said it once back in October 2015. So that the counterclaim was out as of October 2015.
And for Mr. Wecourse to then pass up on the opportunity to appeal that final decision inside of the judge's motion, the order on the motion to vacate and set aside, could have happened in March. Could have happened at the pretrial conference, could have happened at trial, but it didn't. It waited until we would say that there was no jurisdiction for this court to possibly secure.
Have we ever said that an order imposing a discovery sanction is a final appealable order?
No, Your Honor. But again,
wasn't the order dismissing the counterclaim a discovery sanction?
It was a discovery sanction, yes, Your Honor. But again, a discovery sanction is a Nebraska court rule of discovery that falls outside of Chapter 25, which means that it's a special proceeding based on the Jarrett versus Eichler position that this court has had.
Well, before the rules of discovery were codified, wasn't there a statute that's found within Chapter 25 that expressly authorized those discovery rules?
Yes, Your Honor, 25-1147.
And prior to that time, discovery was statutory within Chapter 25. So don't we in effect have an incorporation by reference of the Supreme Court rules into Chapter 25?
That would be an argument that could be made if the repealing of 25-1147 didn't happen 35 years ago, and there be a substantial amount of case law that, again, specifically states that it has to be outside of a Chapter 25 proceeding to be considered a special proceeding. So I've got numerous case law that supplants what I would say what was Nebraska 25-1147 repealed in 1983.
That was the time when the discovery rules were promulgated.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it was pursuant to an express authorization within Chapter 25.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
I see that I have 30 seconds left. If there's no other questions, if that was possible. If there are no other questions, 30 seconds, he'll be fine. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Thompson, we will actually give you 5 minutes, and then we'll give Mr. Arney some rebuttal time.
Very good, Your Honor, and I will be brief. Tom Thompson on behalf of the plaintiff and appellee in this case, Judge Coe. The only thing I want to address is the administrative dismissals that I think occurred twice in this relevant time frame. And the District Court of Douglas County faces this every once in a while, that the court administrator will dismiss a case for lack of prosecution. And they determine that based upon the record. Well, in this case, there was discovery going on. And
what authority does a court administrator have to dismiss a case?
Excuse me?
What authority does a court administrator have to dismiss a pending case?
I believe it is from the district court rules, District Court of Douglas County rules. And I believe, I'm not sure that that's statutory at all. I think it rests with that court.
Aren't all of those orders purported to be signed by one of the judges?
In this particular case, and I think the record will support it because of it's in the transcript, it came from the court administrator.
Well, I think on all of the orders that I've seen in the transcript, there's a judge's signature above the line that says it's being ordered dismissed. You then get down to the court administrator, maybe the one mailing it out.
Yeah, could very well be. In this case, Judge Gleason is not the one who dismissed the case for lack of prosecution because he was aware that there was prosecution going on. When I received it, I immediately filed a motion to reinstate, took it to Judge Gleason.
Let's assume for the moment that the administrative dismissals, the way you characterize right. it, were in fact official, signed by a judge, right. and they actually did dismiss it until reinstatement. What effect, if any, does that have on how this case should be decided?
None, I believe, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the reason being is that it was issued without notice to plaintiff or defendant. And in this case, the judge, and was reinstated with my application, and the judge signed it summarily. Okay. And there just never was any notice, and there's no merits to it.
The court administrator, rightly, wrongly, or at least per custom, looks at activity in a case, and if it looks like it's dormant, does something?
Exactly. And that's what happened in this case, because that's what the record may have shown. But there was active discovery going on. And in fact, in this case, I believe there was a motion pending, and Judge Gleason had no problem in either dismissal.
But that wouldn't be reflected by filings. Not like, how shall I say, the old days when the discovery activity could be reflected in the pleading.
Right. In this case, the discovery would not have been reflected by the pleading.
But your point was that the motion for discovery sanctions was actually pending at the time that the order dismissing for lack of prosecution was entered.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that those administrative dismissals did not affect the merits of the case at all and were not based upon any actionable facts or just facts at the time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Arney. We'll give you 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
Okay, thank you. That's the point. Your Honor, with respect to the motion to reinstate, which was filed on October 1st, even without the Bill of Exceptions, the transcript does show I believe that motion was filed at 8:08 a.m. on October 1st, and I believe hearing was set for 8:30 a.m. also on October 1st, the same day that the motion was filed. Again, as counsel stated, the case had active, or maybe as you might want to characterize it, inactive discovery taking place at the time, and we were aware of the hearing on October 1st, and so it was a surprise when on September 29 I got an order of dismissal. But hypothetically, there may be some very good claims against my client, which could result in a judgment against him. And if that's the case, I don't think I want to encourage the court to enter a judgment against him. So on October 1st, the case was, it had been dismissed. And a motion to reinstate was the appropriate thing. And reinstating the case was the appropriate thing, but notice needed to be given. And then as you can see, as the case goes on, procedurally, it gets dismissed again and reinstated again, and there's strange dates on everything. No appropriate notice was given to the appellant with respect to the reinstatements. And so if there's no questions, I'd conclude.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Now we'll return to State versus Joshua E. Belk. Ms. Duffy, the court's been notified that Mr. Nyman apparently had a medical emergency, and that's why he can't be here today. So I'm wondering if you wouldn't stipulate to having oral arguments on this matter in a future court date. Is